Hi, Patrick Cox here. Remember this?
Abhi ki bar, Trump, Sarkar.
Donald Trump speaking Hindi, sort of. It was last year during the election campaign, and Trump, he was really going after the Indian American vote.
We love the Hindus. We love India.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
Indian American groups invited Trump to talk to them. They held rallies for him. In India, they even built a shrine for him. As it turned out, Indian Americans didn't all vote for Trump, but there were far fewer displays of allegiance to Hillary Clinton, which might have left the casual observer thinking that Indian Americans voted as a bloc. We're almost primed to think that way of the hyphenated electorate. You know, Cuban Americans vote Republican, Mexican Americans Democrat, and now Indian Americans for
Trump, Sarkar.
Trump? Behind those assumptions, of course, is the belief that heritage communities share the same attitudes, the same values. That's the assumption. But hey, we're doing a podcast about this today, so you know we're going to blow up that assumption.
I'm Deepthi Dawar. We are standing here at the California Department of Education for a final hearing on the California textbook controversy. With me right now is
Indian Americans, of course, do not share the same values. In fact, the people being interviewed on this news item, they don't even share the same words.
This is incredibly important to us, to be able to call people by the name that they actually choose and not use offensive terms from the past.
But we want a fair, balanced, and accurate and equitable representation for Indian Hinduism.
This is from DTV USA, by the way, South Asian News and Info for Americans. And from those brief comments, you might not realize how differently those two people see the world. But the words they want to use for place names or for groups of people, they're code for entire belief systems. It's funny, this battle's playing out thousands of miles from India. But, well, it's a very American thing to do, to argue about names and labels and history. So today in the podcast, these questions. What do you call that bit of Asia that wedges into the Indian Ocean that includes not just India, but parts of Pakistan and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka? Do you call it South Asia or do you call it ancient India? And the people who traditionally exist at the lowest rung of India's socioeconomic ladder, do you call them Dalits or untouchables? Or do you not bring them up at all? Do you just avoid all mention of caste classifications like these? The debate about these questions and everything they imply, this reached fever pitch in California a few months ago, just around the time when Indian Americans appeared to be uniting around Donald Trump. And this captivated Sonia Paul. She's a reporter in California who's covered Indians here in the U.S. and back in India. Sonia herself is part Indian, but her family dynamics don't fit neatly into the Indian American experience or into this debate, which is why she wanted to know more. Here's her story.
We are in a large room at the California State Department of Education in Sacramento.
Hello, everyone. My name is Aditya. I'm a second-generation Indian American.
It's a public hearing and packed to the brim. In the aisle between banks of chairs stand mostly Indians, a long line of them, all waiting to speak. Some are young, some old, American-born and immigrants. Many are wearing traditional clothing. Each has just 1 minute to step up to a podium and have their say on their culture's history.
And I'd like to quote Nathan Glazer, a professor emeritus at Harvard. For ancient India, as known to the classical Greeks and to Alexander, and to Greek and Roman geographers, to Portuguese adventurers.
This hearing's organized by a state panel called the Instructional Quality Commission. Every 6 years, the commission recommends updates to the content of school textbooks. Even though this is just for California, you find the same textbooks in many smaller states too.
What other term other than India would serve as an equivalent? They could not conceive of it as South Asia. They knew it as a distinctive civilization stretching from the Indus to the Ganges, from the Himalayas to the Indian Ocean, with its own ancient languages and classic texts and religions descended from them. South Asia is in vogue to avoid offending Pakistan and Bangladesh. But for history before 1947, no other term will serve. Thank you.
I'm also a Hindu of Indian ancestry and don't want to see the textbooks in my home state misrepresenting the millions of Hindus globally, and particularly the Hindu population in California. I want them to be balanced and to offer an enlightened and fair representation of my culture and religion.
This high school student is making the same case as the first one, for the textbooks to refer to this region as ancient India. But she's coming at it from a more overtly religious angle.
It would be a grave disappointment if Hinduism in India were reduced to ancient Indian religions in South Asia. I only ask that Hinduism be afforded the same treatment as other world religions in California textbooks.
There's plenty of support among Indian Americans for this point of view. An online petition, for example, urging California to keep the name Ancient India, got over 25,000 signatures. But this name, Ancient India, that's only the start of it. The people who like that term, they also want the textbooks to stop focusing so much on India's caste system, the ancient way in which Indian society classifies everyone from top to bottom. The origins of the caste system have long been associated with Hinduism. Over time, the system infiltrated other religions in South Asia. And for many millions of Indians, it still exists, holding them back, condemning them, in some cases, to discrimination and poverty. But for many of these Indian Americans, caste is a piece of history. No more, no less.
There is so much more to India than just the caste system, which is now a thing of the past, like the slavery in America. And I think it's fair to learn about the topic, like I was taught in India, but show how the culture has changed. Thank you.
My name is Suhag Shukla. I am a co-founder of the Hindu American Foundation and now serve as its executive director and legal counsel.
The Hindu American Foundation is a prominent Hindu advocacy group in the U.S., and many of its members are here at this hearing. It was started by second-generation Indian Americans. It's a nonprofit, not formally aligned with any political party, but its views often coincide with those of the current Hindu nationalist government of India, because they both aim to protect Hindus from discrimination and to promote the religion. The foundation seeks to educate Americans about it so that they might think of Hinduism as more than, quote, caste, cows, and curry.
I'm a former California public school student. There were actually a very small percentage of Indian Americans. I was one of only a handful in my graduating class. So in ninth grade, when we covered world history, my teacher had me stand up and asked me three simple questions. What caste are you? Is your marriage arranged? And are your parents saving for your dowry?
Suhag is telling me this after one of the textbook hearings.
Now, you can imagine, like, in a sea of blonde and blue eyes, I was the only brunette, let alone one of the only Indians, to be faced with that sort of question when you already have a different name, when you already look different, when, you know, when you go home or you bring friends over, your parents are speaking a different language and they live very differently, you already feel isolated. You already feel conscious about your identity and how you're different.
Things have changed, she says. Most things.
We are so much more diverse a society in the United States. There's so much more awareness with the internet and with different types of people that interact with one another, that to still have the types of stereotypes that we see in the textbooks, to me, is just appalling and shocking.
Right. What do you make of some of the people who went up and claimed that caste doesn't exist? It's not a phenomenon in modern India or modern South Asia. Some people who I guess would be affiliated or assumed to be affiliated with your group are coming out and saying these things. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, our edits and our position on caste and caste-based practices, including caste-based discrimination, are fairly public. Actually, not fairly public, but absolutely and completely public. We have acknowledged that caste-based discrimination is a reality.
But it's not her reality, she says, nor of many Hindus in California.
The way that this whole conversation has been framed is that caste and the practice of caste, without it, you cannot have Hinduism. I'm standing here as a Hindu saying that caste-based discrimination nor the practice of caste is relevant to how I am a Hindu.
I should say that many Indian Americans, they have roots in the higher and mid-level castes, castes which traditionally have had more social and economic opportunity. There are, though, some lower caste Indians in the United States.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Benjamin Kaila.
Benjamin Kaila.
I grew up in India as a Dalit.
A Dalit.
The most and longest discriminated communities in the world. Though we are called by various humiliating names, we prefer to be called as Dalits.
And Dalit means broken or crushed, which represents their status. Benjamin's at this hearing to make the case that the caste system should not be glossed over in the textbooks, as some of the speakers want. If you're ready to whitewash American slavery, the Nazi Holocaust, and South African apartheid, he says, then you can also do the same thing with caste. I hope you don't do that.
The caste system is a fact. It is connected, it's justified in the Hindu scriptures. So whether you like it or not, it's part of the Hindu tradition.
This is Thomas Blem Hansen. He runs the Center for South Asia at Stanford University.
And I think it would be irresponsible romanticism to cut that out just to please some parents in California who may feel uncomfortable today because they have become modern liberal Hindus, that they don't want to be confronted with what's the past and the reality of their own community and how people act and the prejudices that comes with. So the analogy would be like to say, well, there are some white kids who feel uncomfortable hearing about slavery, so we shouldn't teach slavery because really it makes them feel terrible.
Hansen tells me that although America's immigration system attracts mostly higher caste Indians, something unexpected happens to them once they arrive.
What happens when you come to America? All of a sudden you become another brown minority among a lot of other brown minorities of which America sees more and more. It's a very common experience that there was has been a certain unease with this, because it's like all of a sudden having come out of a privileged existence in India, being placed in a sort of middle class, lower middle class position where you in a sense have to struggle to be recognized.
And so in Hansen's view, that's part of what we're seeing in this textbook controversy, an effort to maintain that pride and self-esteem.
To claim a place that is more commensurate with how many in the community actually see themselves, which is heirs to a great and ancient civilization.
Hence their demand to keep the region's name as ancient India rather than South Asia. And when it comes to the reluctance among many Indian Americans to acknowledge the caste system?
I think that has to do with a way in which people from privileged and higher caste communities are not used to see caste as a problem. They're actually caste blind, because when you are privileged, you don't see it. It's like asking privileged Bostonian white people whether race is a problem for them, whether they think race is a problem in America. They'll probably say for some people it is, but really it's not, you know, such a big problem. But if you ask people who have grown up Dalit or grown up from in lower caste communities, they will tell you a different story.
Okay, so Sonia, what happens to caste when you enter the U.S.? I mean, the rest of us here, the non-Indians, we don't really have the code. We don't recognize it.
Yeah, it's hard. It's not like people state their caste in applying for U.S. visas or citizenship, and it's certainly not a category on the U.S. Census form. It kind of just goes underground here.
What about your family then? I mean, you grew up in California, right, with a mainly Indian heritage. Were the people in your family who felt that the textbooks got the history wrong?
Well, in a way, my family sidesteps all of this because we're mixed. My father's from India, but my mother's part Filipino, part Indian, born in the Philippines. So we were always a bit out of the mainstream. And it wasn't like there was a textbook history that reflected my personal history. And even with my dad, 100% Indian. But there are things about his upbringing that shows how he's not going to take sides in this argument over our history. I talked with him about this at a place near my parents' house where my father often goes, the Gurdwara, otherwise known as a Sikh temple. It's a stone's throw away from the Catholic church where my siblings and I would go with my mom when we were little. In fact, my dad would come with us too sometimes, just as my mom would go to the Gurdwara. After the evening prayer ends, my dad explains to me what life was like growing up in his home state of Punjab in India.
Of course, I was surrounded by people who are Punjabi, mostly people who are farmers, and they all belong to one religion called Sikh.
One religion called Sikhism.
So I was automatically identified as a person who has to worship Sikh religion. But my parents were from Hindu religion. My parents' parents were Hindus. So I identified myself to be Hindu, although I was surrounded by Punjabis and I go to a Sikh temple for worship because that was near.
So there isn't really an equivalent of this in the U.S.? I mean, you typically don't have Christians identifying as Christians going to worship in a Jewish temple. But that's what my dad did. Belief, for some Indians at least, is more fluid. And my dad still prays at a Sikh Gurdwara, but he also keeps pictures and small idols of Hindu gods at home for prayer. If you visit Punjab, you can witness this fluidity between the religions. And despite some doctrinal hardlining on both sides, it's still largely accepted.
Wow, that's so very different from the United States. I wonder for your family, I mean, once they moved over here, how did all of that translate?
Well, here our value on identity leaves little room for these gray areas, right? I mean, all of us outside the white Judeo-Christian majority, we spend so much of our energy just struggling to be recognized. It doesn't really help me to say I grew up a little bit Hindu, a little bit Sikh, and a little bit Catholic. My dad, though, he ignores U.S. identity politics. And I ask him what he thinks of some of these themes from the textbook debate.
Do you think there is a one or correct way to describe Hindu history?
One way and correct way to describe Hindu?
His brow furrows. I can tell he's never thought about this before.
Under Hindu religion, there are many different gods. There are many different worshippers. There are many different type of temples. Historians could write a thesis on this one.
Okay, so I think I'm just about starting to get it. Like, there's this hugely complex and diverse religion, and the American version of this religion, well, you know, how it's written about in this country, it doesn't do it justice. Also, your dad, just like some other Indians I've met, he doesn't need to define things as precisely as a lot of us Westerners do.
Yeah.
So what about caste? Does your dad find his identity at all through caste?
Yeah, I ask him about that. He does and he doesn't. Like, it gives him a sense of belonging. His caste is Kumar, a community that traditionally worked in pottery. But he doesn't do anything like stick to his caste only.
Does he have friends from other castes?
Yeah, of course. But it's irrelevant to the friendships. And when he hears people disapproving of, say, mixed caste marriages, he finds it pretty silly and unnecessary.
And what about you? I mean, your name, Sonia Paul, that to me, that doesn't give away much at all. I mean, I wouldn't even know your heritage from it, let alone which Indian caste you might be associated with.
Yeah, I know. But insiders seeing a brown face with my last name would take a guess. Like, oh, are you Christian? Are you Bengali? Are you Punjabi? Mostly in India, Paul is considered a Christian last name.
All right. So not exactly the whole backstory.
Yeah, no. You can say there's a Christian side that comes from a Catholic upbringing, but that's from my Filipino heritage. And I take my last name from my dad. And he also changed his name slightly twice when he was growing up because kids in his class had the same last name. So originally it was actually Bhupal, then it became Paul, then it became Paul.
Wow. I mean, as random as that, just another kid in the class with the same name. So it sounds like it's pretty fallible, this name coding system, and incredibly easy to misinterpret.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, your name or the perception of it has this huge influence over how people treat you. Remember Benjamin Kayla, the man at the textbook hearing who was Dalit, who was arguing not to gloss over the caste system?
Hmm.
Well, after I heard him, I wanted to know more about his name and his history. So I went to visit him at his home. Benjamin lives near San Jose, California.
Hello.
Hi.
And he comes from a Christian family in southern India, but it wasn't always that way.
We were all Hindus once.
They were all Hindus in his family. And I can understand Ben perfectly, by the way, but his accent may sound heavier to you than some of the other people I talk with.
My grandfather was a Hindu, untouchable Hindu. But at that time, untouchability was very prevalent and he was not able to go anywhere.
Meaning he couldn't get ahead in life. Untouchable is the old word for Dalit. You were untouchable because traditionally it was your role to clean up after others. Dalits held the jobs considered the most impure and were barred from entering the same spaces as dominant caste groups. So, Ben's grandfather decided to convert to Christianity to escape the caste system. But people still knew the family was from the Dalit caste.
When I say my name, Benjamin Paul, they will think I am one of the Dalit communities.
Benjamin is a so-called plain name that's understood to be Christian, which in his home state in India means he's Dalit. Paul is his middle name, Kayla is his last name. While Dalits were historically tasked with low-level jobs, Benjamin's father was able to get a job as a teacher. But despite this professional advancement, caste still reared its head, which is why when Benjamin was 9, he was actually beaten by a school principal who was of a higher caste. And that's also why his father dared not intervene.
He couldn't open his mouth because he may lose his job. And then, till his death, whenever he remembers that incident, he used to say, "I'm sorry I couldn't do anything when that guy was beating you like that when you were 9 years old."
When he grew up, Benjamin worked as a software programmer.
And wherever I work, I am the only Dalit candidate in those places. And I have been treated differently.
He was often given the least important tasks and was denied access to technology that would have improved his skills. All the while, he was reading more and more about caste discrimination and about Dalit civil rights.
How much history we had, how much we missed because it was not taught anywhere.
He decided he wanted to go to the U.S., He figured he could earn more and send money back to Dalit communities in India. Lucky for him, a certain drama was gripping the world at the time.
That bug, the millennium bug.
There still exists a general state of either denial, complacency, or even apathy about both the reality and the potential effects of Y2K.
This fear that computer systems would shut down was a huge deal. A Bay Area company recruited Benjamin, and so he got a work visa. In the years after, he sought out communities of other Dalits in America. And so he did what anyone searching for non-mainstream groups might do. He turned to the internet.
Looking on the internet, and I found a group called Dalits Yahoo Groups.
And he had to apply twice to convince them of his Dalit identity. Now, 18 years later, he's still here. Still messaging with other Dalits and meeting them when possible, and still working with mostly other Indians.
So, that being said, how open are you about your identity here in the Bay Area?
Not in the offices. Offices, we are not open.
So, how many Indians are in your office?
Oh, my office, mostly 90% of them are Indians.
According to the Census Bureau, more than 370,000 Indians have moved to California since the year 2000. Many of them to Silicon Valley. And many cities in this area, where Ben lives and works, are now super Indian. So it's not that surprising that Benjamin's office is what it is, almost like being back in India in a certain way.
That's my experience. And we talk in offices, Dalits are one or two, and we don't identify ourselves. Even if there are there, when you get identified, you will be treated differently. Therefore, in the office, I am Benjamin, that's all.
Benjamin, that's all, he says. Just Benjamin. A few weeks after my conversation with Benjamin, I'm back in Sacramento at yet another textbook hearing. It's the last of the hearings, after which the Instructional Quality Commission will vote on its recommendations. In the lobby, people cluster into groups according to which side of history they stand on. Some have large posters in their hands. Opponents stare at each other every so often. It's pretty tense.
Folks! They end in closed session, okay? We're gonna let people in, but you need to do it in an orderly fashion, okay? Thank you.
And those saving seats, please.
There's not enough space in the hearing room for everyone, so people also linger in the lobby and watch a live stream of the hearing playing on a screen.
I'm Ehsan Khan, and I'm with South Asian Histories for All and a father of four kids.
Everyone seems like a seasoned campaigner now. When people step up to the podium, others instantly hold up their signs with slogans like, "Don't erase Hinduism," "Don't erase Dalit," and "Every culture must be respected."
Hello and namaste. My name is Madhav Nekar, and I'm a senior at Westmont High School in Campbell. The images that I'm about to show you are from actual textbooks presently used in classrooms today and are emblematic of the way that different religions and societies are taught to my peers.
A man standing next to the student holds up the enlarged images of textbook pages.
First, we have Judaism, which is depicted with beautiful artwork and families celebrating a religious holiday over a shared meal. Christianity is likewise depicted with beautiful artwork. Islam is similarly depicted with diverse communities in prayer and pilgrimages. Now, you'd expect similar treatment for Hinduism. However, my religion is shown with an impoverished woman walking away from a pile of trash, with an inset photograph of a priest looking in disgust. I urge the board to adopt a framework that is accurate, culturally competent, and treats Hinduism with the same level of dignity that is afforded to other religions. Thank you.
Looking at the evidence, hearing his passion, and knowing how outsiders may perceive and target brown people, it's easy to empathize. I get that sinking feeling in my stomach. But I get it for another reason, too. That impoverished woman in the picture is probably a Dalit, a Hindu, but an untouchable one.
Is there any further discussion by the board members?
Finally, there's the vote.
Not all those in favor, raise your hands. All right, the framework is approved unanimously. Do we deserve a break?
Yes.
The commission members endorse a new textbook framework. They decide to include discussions of the caste system and the name Dalit, which pleases Benjamin and is a blow for the Hindu activists. But on the other main bone of contention, the commission votes to call this region ancient India, not South Asia. A compromise of sorts. The Hindu activists are much happier with this.
Wonderful work. Thank you.
After the hearing ends, many people come up to thank the commission members for their hard work. But no one is fully satisfied. Some say they can hardly wait until another 6 years is up, when they can do this all over again. And maybe get a bit more about what they think their history is about into school textbooks.
Basically, what we did is look, we had four or five of them saying very similar things. So we thought we had one.
Sonia Paul is a reporter based in California. She mentioned that you might have some trouble understanding one of the speakers there, Benjamin, the Dalit guy. I think it's worth pointing out that in editing Sonia's story, we engaged in a degree of discrimination. I asked Sonia to cut some of the things Benjamin said because his accent was so heavy. I played the audio to other people I work with, and they often didn't understand what he was saying. As a lower caste Indian, Benjamin didn't go to a fancy school where they taught, quote, accent reduction. So although he does speak very good English, you can't always make it out, unless, like Sonia, your ear is attuned to Indian English. There's no point in putting out a podcast that's incomprehensible. But this isn't an isolated incident. Editors all over the world make calls on accents and intelligibility, which means that often people at the bottom of the pile don't always get to speak for themselves. One person who does speak for himself, quite a lot, is Donald Trump.
Abhi ki bar, Trump, Sarkar.
So that little slogan in Hindi that he whipped out during his campaign, it means this time a Trump government. And it's actually borrowed from Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
Ab ki baar Modi sarkar.
This time a Modi government. I have Rupa Shenoy to thank for this. She has the backstory of the Trump Hindi ad in a recent episode of the Otherhood podcast. The episode's called How Indian Americans Made Trump Look Good. You may have heard me plug Otherhood before. That's because it's really good. And now, the end. Of this episode, at least. Thanks to Nina Porzuki and Rupa Shenoy for help with editing. Thanks also to Louis Cronin, Robin Moore, Andrew Sussman, Catherine Whelan, and Mike Wilkins. And to Clark Boyd for studio time and bread. The World in Words is a production of PRI's The World. That's a radio show on every weekday on your local public radio station.
Modi, 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 Modi!
Our home on the internet is, well, we've got many. Facebook, Twitter, PRI.org/language, and wherever you listen to podcasts. And please, don't forget to leave a review there. Thanks very much, and we'll be back soon.